Welcome to the podcast of this Brecan information session. Information sessions are recorded at the Brecan Resource Centre and can be borrowed in CD format from the Resource Library. Sessions are copyrighted and are for personal home use only. If you would like to know more about this and other sessions, please contact Brecan on 1300 781 500. We hope you enjoy this podcast. This session was recorded on the 22nd of August 2013 at the Brecan Resource Centre, located in Melbourne's CBD. In this session, Dr. Leonie Constable explains what happens from the time of the initial biopsy to the test results, the level of information you can expect, the criteria for staging a tumour, and how a pathologist works with the medical team. We hope you enjoy this session.
Okay, well, thank you for inviting me here. I've come here and spoken a couple of times now, so it's always nice to get out and meet the patients and perhaps some patient relatives that are at the end of the report that we make. So the pathology report's really quite a detailed document, if you like, and really we're writing the information that the clinicians need to treat. So we try and make it full of information. It can be a little bit daunting, and it's obviously quite a complex uses a lot of medical terminology, so it's understandable that people who aren't necessarily medical won't understand everything on it. But today I'll hope to try and explain some of the items on that report and answer any of your questions. So basically, I'm a pathologist, so what that means is that I'm a doctor. So all pathologists are medically qualified, so we've all done a basic medical degree and then we go on and specialise, just like a surgeon does or an oncologist. And basically we work in the area of diagnosis of disease. So it's not just cancer diagnosis, there's lots of other diseases that occur that we also are involved with. And generally we pathologists work in either big hospitals, the Royal Melbourne or the Alfred or the Austin, or in private pathology laboratories, and that's where I work at Melbourne Pathology. And there are lots of different types of pathologists, just like there's lots of different types of surgeons. So not all surgeons do everything, so not all pathologists do everything. But the people that sort of get involved in cancer diagnosis are essentially what we call histopathologists and surgical and cytopathologists. So really, we're the people that look at tissue taken out at surgery. In America, they call them surgical pathologists, which I actually think is quite a good term because people sort of understand something's taken out at surgery. Where does it go? To the surgical pathologist. But there's also people who are pathologists who work in infectious diseases. There's people that look at the blood. There's people that look at the immune system. So it's a complex area, the whole of pathology, but really what I do is surgical pathology. Okay. Now, basically, when we need to make a diagnosis of a breast cancer or a gynecological cancer, we're the people that specimens are sent to. And really, the doctor may suspect that there's a lump or a mass or is concerned, but really the diagnosis results from actually getting tissue and looking at it down the microscope. So we get the tissue. This is sort of a broad overview of what happens. We get the tissue, it's looked at down the microscope, and then we issue the report, and then the doctor can work from that. That sounds very quick and easy and simple, but it's actually a very long process. Surgical pathology is a little bit different in the sense that it's just like getting a blood sample and putting it into the machine, and the machine spits out the answer. Easy. Takes maybe less than 5 minutes. Surgical pathology is much more complicated. There's a whole team of people that are involved, so it's not just pathologists at the end point looking at the slides. It's actually a whole group of people who work in the laboratory, laboratory technicians, laboratory assistants, laboratory scientists. And all of these people have a very specific role to play with the tissue that the surgeon gives to the laboratory. So just how do we make the diagnosis of cancer? Well, essentially we suspect it clinically because there's a lump or a mass or an abnormal thickening. We can do special tests using x-rays, mammography, ultrasound. There's all these modalities that can be used. But really, the diagnosis has to be done on a tissue sample. It's sort of like the gold standard, which is why I sort of got interested in pathology, because it's like, there's the answer. That's the answer, and no one can dispute it. There it is on the slide. Now, this is a little bit complex and I won't spend too much time on it, but you can have, I don't know if anybody in the room here has perhaps had something called an FNA biopsy, where it's a very skinny little needle put in, a few cells are taken out and put onto a slide. There's no anaesthetic, there's no operation, it's very quick, very simple.
Many years ago.
So sometimes there's a core biopsy, that's actually a tissue piece, but this is perhaps not being used as much nowadays, but it's a very... Nowadays we actually take a we can take a skinny core of tissue, so it's actually like a biopsy gun. So, for example, you might have it done under an ultrasound control. They see a mass in the breast, localise it with the ultrasound, put this very skinny needle in and take a biopsy.
Like a gun.
So they're sort of the simple ways of getting a biopsy. Alternatively, you may actually have to go to a formal operation, put to sleep, operating theatre, etc. Where the cytology sample is a bit like having a blood test. It's very quick and easy. It's a rapid turnaround time, but we don't get quite as much information. So nowadays, essentially, the surgeons will really go for tissue, whole pieces of tissue, not just cells. Whatever way it happens, the cytology, basically, you just pull out some cells with a small needle, put them onto a slide, and then look under a microscope. It's quite quick and can lead to a diagnosis quite quickly, but sometimes it isn't as good as, in most cases, it doesn't give you all the information that the doctor needs. Obviously, onto the slide, looks down the microscope. We might just leave that there. But the problem is we don't get enough information. So really what we're talking about is histological specimens or surgical biopsies. So solid pieces of tissue, whether it's just a little core biopsy or a bigger piece of tissue that requires a formal operation. And that tissue has to be examined very carefully by the pathologist. We have to sample the appropriate areas, and then they have to be processed into a machine overnight, and then they have to be sampled onto glass slides. So I might just sort of go through the steps with that. When we get a piece of tissue in the laboratory, if it's a very big piece of tissue, we don't put all of it in necessarily, because a mastectomy specimen, for example, there's only going to be a small tumour and perhaps the rest of the breast is completely benign. So we don't put all of the breast in, we select the tumour. And we select the area of interest into what these little plastic containers are, and they're put into a machine. So we select carefully what we think looks abnormal. So we're trained to recognise normal tissue from abnormal tissue. We select it and they're put into these little cassettes. And then these cassettes are put into machines. And these are overnight, so overnight processing. And there's a whole team of scientists and technicians that are filling up these with chemicals, etc. At the end of coming out of the machine, we've got a piece of tissue inside this little plastic cassette. Then they have to be actually infiltrated with hot wax. We've got to have some means of cutting the tissue. And what we do is pour the hot wax in, and that solidifies. You end up with the tissue embedded in wax. And then you've got something to actually be able to cut very thin sections. So then... No, it's very inert. Yeah, it's very safe, very inert, doesn't affect at all. It's just a good medium for which the tissue sits. And the interesting thing is that those blocks we can store for years. You can store them for 20, 30, 40 years. And the good thing is that you can actually go back and get those blocks out if there's a new special test that's come through and test it again.
How old is this?
100 years? Quite old. Yeah, it's quite an old technique, yeah. I mean, the machines and things become more sophisticated, but the actual process of cutting tissue is really quite old, yeah. So what we're doing, what the scientist is doing here is we've got, this is called the microtome, so this is a very, very sharp blade here. We've put the little block with the tissue, and then we sort of slice down, and we end up with very, very thin slivers here. So that central bit there is the actual tissue, and then it's supported by the wax. And then what they do is they come in with a glass slide, and they scoop that up, and then you've got the tissue on the slide. That's fantastic, but it's not great for us to look at because there's no contrast, so then it has to be stained. So what happens then is that then they're put into dye, essentially the dye, which you know highlights different parts of the cells. And so they go through this sequence of stains, and then at the end we have slides to look at. So the piece of tissue sitting on the glass, patient's name, number, identifying details, etc. So that's at the end of the day what we end up with to look at down the microscope.
I was just going to ask, you know when they do the search on that, they say they put a dye in the slide
back. Mm-hmm.
So that dye then reveals?
Sometimes we can actually see that dye, yes, and but it doesn't affect our processing. It's just sometimes we can actually see it as a coloured dye. And it actually can be quite helpful sometimes. If what do they do sometimes is called do a tattoo, so that we can actually see the tattoo and say, ah, that's where we need to sample. So that can be quite a helpful technique, just as a by-the-by thing, yeah. Okay, so we look down the microscope, we assess all the factors, we do whatever, and then we make a diagnosis. Now, essentially, what I was talking about is that this histological specimen, it does take longer. So that whole thing probably takes 24 hours. So it's not a 5-minute result. It's a day, sometimes might be a little bit longer if the tissue needs to be fixed properly. That is, it's put into a formalin fixative, which makes it, it sort of, if you like, preserves it. And sometimes if the tissue isn't fixed, then it might be 2 days before we can actually cut it. So it can be a couple of days before the result is given back to the doctor, but we try and be as prompt as we can. Sometimes we need to go back to the specimen and take more tissue, or we need to do some special stains. So it's quite a detailed process. The good thing about having those blocks is that we've always got tissue there, and we can go back and we can test for hormone receptors. So I'm sure you've all heard of ER, PR, HER2. So once we've got the tissue preserved in the laboratory, we can now use that block for these extra special tests that aid in how we're going to treat the patient. Now, when I say we make a diagnosis, essentially what we then do is do a formal histological report, and that report is what's sent to the doctor. For some biopsies, for example, little skin biopsies, they're quite simple. For a breast cancer, it's quite a detailed report. It can be 2, sometimes 3 pages. So there's a lot of information that we need to include in that report and that the doctor is looking for to help guide future therapy. So all the information that we put in that report helps not just the surgeon, but it's obviously going to also help the oncologist. It may help the radiation oncologist. And really what they're wanting to work out is what's going to be the best treatment and what's going to be the likelihood of response to treatment. So we basically use what are called standardised reports. So there are certain categories that we really must include because they need to know that to work out which treatment pathway to go down. Yes, absolutely. Yes, I'll go through them all. So I'm sort of focusing more perhaps on the breast cancer report, but gynecological cancers are the same. There's just a couple of items that sometimes are a little bit different, but it depends on what organ we're talking about. Uterus is slightly different to ovaries, slightly different to cervix, for example. So, but breast is very standardised, and you might get 10 standardised breast reports from 10 different pathology companies, and they'll pretty much all have the same categories. So what are the important things that need to be transmitted to the doctor? So they need to know the size of the tumour, how big it is. They want to know the margins. Now what we're talking about there is how far is the lump or the cancer from the margin of the tissue? Have we got a good rim of benign tissue around the tumour? What sort of tumour is it? And whether there are any lymph nodes involved. But I'll go through sort of step by step each category as we go through. So if we sort of look at the headings, these are the sorts of things that should be on any standard breast cancer report. So firstly, the operative specimen. What have we actually got? Is it a mastectomy? Is the whole breast been taken off? Or is it what we call a wide local excision? Is it a lumpectomy? Is there a needle hook wire in there? Or is it a core biopsy? Okay, so that's just really to indicate to anyone reading it what procedure has the patient undergone, what amount of tissue has been taken. what side it is, very important. Sometimes there's mislabeling. Sometimes the theatre right left and it's actually right. I mean, these sorts of things happen. So we have to go through and make sure it's all correct, everything matches up. Now, the tumour type. Most tumour types are what we call invasive ductal cancers or no special type cancers. And I'll talk about that a little bit more in a moment. And then we've got the grade of the tumour, size, etc., etc., etc. For breast cancer, these are special, hormone receptors and the HER2 status. Are you sort of familiar with HER2 people? Anyway, I'll talk about that later, and then pathological stage at the end. So if we go through each sort of thing in sequence, so the type of tumour. There's probably 20 different types of actual breast cancers that are categorised pathologically. The two commonest are invasive ductal cancer and invasive lobular cancer, and there's also what we call pre-invasive cancer, which is DCIS. The same thing. So what we're talking about with DCIS is that basically the breast is really just a system of ducts. There's sort of secretion of milk at the end, and then they've got to get somewhere, so they go via the ducts to the nipple. So this is a normal duct with a lining of cells. And sometimes these cells start to grow and proliferate and become hyperplastic, and then they start to get disorganised. And then that's very, very disorganised, and that's still within that duct or the pipe, if you like. So that duct is what when we look down the microscope, that's what we call DCIS. So the duct is completely filled with these tumour cells, but they haven't actually gone beyond the duct yet. So it hasn't become invasive. That's invasive. It's broken through. Well, that means that it's now a fully fledged invasive cancer that does have the capacity to spread beyond the breast. That's a little bit different because it's a little bit different because the tissues are different. But I can talk about that a bit later. But I know some people, I mean, we're picking up this DCIS a lot more because it's seen on mammograms, obviously, because it sometimes has calcium in it. Yeah. So it's... That's right. It's actually pre-invasive cancer. This is invasive because it's spread through. Okay, so some people only have DCIS and they may need no further treatment or they may just need some radiotherapy. We'll just come to that a little bit later. And then invasive tumours may need some chemotherapy, may need some radiotherapy, it depends. But this, obviously, because it's become invasive and it's spread into the surrounding breast tissues, that has a greater capacity to spread beyond the breast than if it's still confined to the little duct. Okay. Now, another heading in that report is the tumour grade. Now, the grade is really referring to how well the cancer cells look like normal breast cells. So we talk about grade 1, grade 2 and grade 3. And grade 1 tumours or grade 1 breast cancers, the tumour cells actually look, well, they most closely resemble normal cells. So they don't look too different from the normal breast cells. They're abnormal, but they're not too different to them, so they're low grade. And then at the other end of the spectrum, high grade, grade 3 tumours, the cells look quite different. They look quite ugly, they're quite aggressive, and we can tell that just looking at the microscope at their appearance. And in between we have what's called intermediate grade 2. It's somewhere between low grade and high grade. That would be grade 2, intermediate grade. So if we'd go back and sort of little quick biology lesson, but this is a cell, so all cells have got this central nucleus with the cytoplasm around it, and these are normal looking cells, so they look nice and regular, and the nucleus is sort of, you know, all the same size, everything's nice and neat. Cancer cells, the nucleus becomes quite big, it becomes dark, it becomes ugly, it fills up much more of the cytoplasm, so that looks very different to a normal cell. Yeah, there's much less. There's much more nucleus compared to cytoplasm because it's rapidly proliferating. It's sort of lost control of its normal growth patterns. So we look down the microscope and we immediately say, aha, these are high-grade looking cells. They look very different to normal cells. This is a grade 3 cancer. Well, in fact, we don't just look at the nucleus to assess the grade. We also look at how many mitoses there are. Mitosis is a reflection of how often the cell is dividing and turning over. So if there's a lot of mitotic figures, that means it's very rapidly dividing and growing. No. And we also look at, are the cells trying to form the usual structures we see in the breast, or are they just completely disorganised? So there's a couple of sort of things we look at to sort out what the grade is. And there's a complex grading system, but essentially it'll be either grade 1, 2 or grade 3. Does that make sense? It's a lot of information to take in, so hopefully it's making some sense.
Can you give us a look something? Like, pick up and go back,
check. I think you can keep a copy. Now, the tumour size is obviously important, and the reports will usually give that tumour size in millimetres, and that's important because the T grade depends on how big the tumour is. So T1 tumours are any tumours that are less than 20 millimetres, so less than 2 centimetres. T2 tumours are between 20 and 50 millimetres, and T3 tumours are more than 50 millimetres. And then there's this category here where it doesn't matter what size the tumour is, but it's actually invaded into the chest wall. So these are the sort of things that we look up. We have special charts. I meant to actually bring a book to show you how complex this grading and size system is, and it's different for each different organ. So this is not the same for the endometrium. It's not the same for the ovary. It's different for the bowel. So there are different staging systems for each area of the body that we're talking about.
Is T2 also considered early stage?
That's different. The stage is a reflection of how far the tumour spread in the body. T is just the tumour size, okay? It's the primary tumour size. How big is that primary tumour? And even T1 we divide up into T1A and T1B and T1C. So there's little subcategories within all of this. So a little T1A tumour is less than 5 millimetres. It's tiny. But they're usually grade 1. And they're usually tumours that don't need any further treatment, as an example. In comparison, a tumour that's 55 millimetres, that's a big tumour. It's likely to be high grade and it's likely to have already spread to lymph nodes. So things tend to go together. Small size tend to be low grade. Very big tumours tend to be high grade. It's not always the case, but we tend to see that sort of correlation. In the endometrium, you see the size isn't that important. It's how far it's gone through the wall of the uterus. Yeah, it sort of depends where you are. Yeah. Look, often in fact, because that's usually a fairly advanced case, it may be the case that they wouldn't operate. They may just do a quick biopsy to prove. Get the receptor status, and then perhaps some chemo and radiotherapy. Wouldn't even try surgery if it's a very invasive thing that's invaded into muscle and ribs. Well, they may just do a biopsy to confirm that, yes, it is in the rib, or yes, it's in the muscle, but not actually attempt a whole resection, because that would be a very major procedure, and you try and shrink things down first, perhaps with chemotherapy or radiotherapy. Look, it depends where they're biopsying. Most of the biopsy cores wouldn't be any longer than two centimetres. Yeah, just to get a tissue diagnosis. But that would be sort of an advanced stage. Sometimes, that's actually a good point, because sometimes, say a tumour that's 50 millimetres, the surgeon may think, oh, I'm really reluctant to take out such a big tumour. I'd like to see if I can shrink it down first. So then you have what's called preoperative chemotherapy. So before the final surgery, patients may have 3 cycles of chemo to try and shrink it down. It shrinks down to 10 millimetres. Great. Now I can take the breast off and the surgery is much better, much easier, better recovery time. Wounds will heal, etc. So sometimes that's an option. Mammogram can give an idea of the size, and so can ultrasound, but they're not absolute, because you can get other benign processes that look like they're part of the tumour but they're actually not when we get the specimen. So they can certainly give a guide and...
Like this one that you're saying, 50 millimetres for any size of the patient, anyway, they can find out through membrane
or
ultrasound,
but
they can't
exactly
see that.
No, but I mean, clinically palpating, assessing... You're right, looking at the mammogram and the ultrasound size, but it's one of those things I just know from experience that sometimes people are quite surprised at the difference between what they thought on ultrasound was going to be the tumour size compared to what it is when we get the specimen. So certainly, yeah, I mean, all that radiology helps, but often actually just having the specimen in front of you is the gold standard. Now, specimen margins. This is really important if only part of the breast has been taken out. So there's been a swing away from taking the whole breast off, doing a mastectomy for small tumours. So surgeons now often will just take a part of the breast out, and that's called a lumpectomy or a wide local excision. So what they're trying to do is take the tumour, but actually take a nice healthy rim of tissue around the tumour so that there's a margin of benign tissue. And you may hear terms like a positive margin or a negative margin. So the margin is where the surgeon's actually cut, and he hopes that there is benign, healthy tissue at that margin, not tumour. So a negative margin means that there's no tumour there. The tumour's clear of that margin. A positive margin means that there are tumour cells where the surgeon has cut, so that's important because that needs to be further managed. Sometimes the surgeon has to go back, perhaps do a mastectomy. Or if it's difficult to go back or for some other reason surgery is not an option, there may be some radiotherapy to mop up the cells that are presumably left behind. So what we're talking about there is the rim of healthy tissue around the tumour. We don't want tumour sitting at the margin, because if you cut through the margin, that means there's tumour left behind. Does that make sense? Positive and negative margins? Okay. Sometimes the surgeons, we say, look, it's very close to the margin, it's within a millimetre, and the radiation oncologist will say, that's fine, we'll give some radiotherapy and that should pick up anything left behind. And sometimes the surgeon can't go any further, like they're already down to the muscle or they've already taken up the anterior fatty part of the skin, I can't go any more, we'll just do radiotherapy to cope with these margins. But really only... an issue when we're talking about when only part of the breast has been taken out. Mastectomies, normally there's lots of healthy tissue around a tumour because it's a big specimen. Now, vascular invasion is something that is usually written on the report. And what are we talking about? What do we mean? What we mean is that there's actually tumour cells inside a blood vessel. So that means the tumour's gained access to the circulation, and it means that there might be an indication for higher risk of tumour spreading elsewhere. So it's already in the vessels, so it can go to the nodes, it might go to the bone, it might go to the liver. So it just means that it's already showing signs that it can invade blood vessels, and it potentially might invade beyond the breast. So that might indicate to the oncologist perhaps, well, look, I see that there's a lot of, here's the tumour, but all around here I can see lots of lymph blood vessels with tumour in them. So I'm going to give this patient really aggressive chemotherapy because it's possible that it's on its way to spread elsewhere and we want to catch it early. We see it. We see it down the microscope. We see the tissue, so we can see blood vessels, we see nerves, we see tumour cells. We actually see the vessels. They're like little spaces, and we see tumour inside the blood vessels. So the surgeon, unless it's very, very advanced, the surgeon won't see that. It's something that you can only see at the microscopic level. Okay.
When these thoughts spread,
yes.
They inject dye into the...
Yeah, I'm coming to that. Lymph nodes. So basically the nodes that what we call drain the breast are the axillary nodes. So the nodes under the armpit here. And for gynecological cancers, it's nodes in the pelvis. Now, we found out that usually there's a sentinel node, which is the node that the tumour will drain to first. So if there's going to be tumour spread, it'll be in that sentinel node. And what they do with the dye is inject into the breast. The dye travels to the node. The first node it hits, the surgeon can see it. He says, oh, here's the blue node, because that's the one it's gone to first. That's the sentinel node. That's where there's likely to be tumour if it's spread, so I'll take that node out only. And if that's negative, that's a fairly good indication that there hasn't been any spread to any of the other lymph nodes.
So there's 1 to 3
nodes? Sometimes you may have 3 nodes and they all look like they've got blue dye in them, so he'll take all of them out. And then we look at them very, very carefully. We slice them up. We look at lots of... We cut through it and look at lots of different levels. Sometimes we put a special stain on. So we have to look really, really hard to see if there's any tumour cells at all anywhere within those nodes. And that's why you might see a report that says lymph nodes are positive, 4 out of 15 contain tumour, or negative, 15 benign nodes, so none out of 15 contain tumour. That's a negative result, if you like.
When would that happen?
Well, I guess more so in the old days when they used to just take out the whole, every node.
But they're still happening now. I've got a friend who had all her blood taken out and they found that it was negative. And I said, how come they didn't inject a dye into you? It looked like I was lucky.
It depends. There's a couple of reasons why. It might be sometimes if you've had previous surgery in the breast, that interferes with the drainage, and doing the sentinel node test, it won't work because the drainage system has been interfered with due to previous surgery, so you won't get a good result with the sentinel node biopsy, and it won't be helpful. Not really. You can get scarring, so that the drainage system is not as easy to follow when doing the injection technique. They may have done a core biopsy and found one node positive and were concerned. The patient didn't want to have 2 operations, so they took them all out. There's a lot of reasons why. It's a bit. Everybody's got a different scenario. Everybody's. That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. There are a whole lot of factors. It's surgeon factors, patient factors, environment factors. Every case is not going to be the same. So, I mean, it's probably puzzling to you to say, oh, but I didn't have that and they did. But there'd be an explanation for that. I mean, and in one way you can say, well, that's an excellent result because they've cleared the axilla and there was no tumour, so that's great.
Yeah. Yeah,
there can be side effects, which is why they went to the sentinel node technique to try and avoid taking out a lot of them here. Anyway, so lymph node involvement really is an indication of has the tumour spread locally to those draining nodes, and that is a very important factor as to what sort of treatment's going to follow. So when we do get what's called the whole axillary dissection, we have to sort of very carefully go through all the fat and find all the lymph nodes and sample them and count up how many there are, and if there's 15, how many have tumour? 4 out of 15. And again, that comes into the staging. Because if you have one node out of 15, that's a different stage to having 9 nodes positive out of 15. It's an increased tumour burden. So that's a factor that goes into the follow-up treatment. Hormone receptors. So for breast cancer, we always test for estrogen, ER, and progesterone, PR receptors. And when we say that a tumour is ER positive, what do we mean? What we mean is that the tumour cells actually have little estrogen receptors on them, and we can utilise that by using anti-estrogen tablets to stop the action and stop the cell growing. So tamoxifen is an anti-estrogenic drug, so if your tumour is ER positive, treat with tamoxifen to try and kill off or stop the cells that have got the receptor from continuing to grow and proliferate. If a patient is ER and PR negative, then there's really no benefit in treating with tamoxifen because they're not expressing it, so it's not going to be of any use. So you may say, oh, that patient has breast cancer and now they're on tamoxifen, why am I not on tamoxifen? The most likely answer is that because you're ER negative and you'll get no benefit. So we have to use very specific treatments depending on what the tumour cells are doing. Same sort of thing with HER2. This is something that's become more prominent in later years. And HER2 is a normal gene that's involved in cell growth. Now, some breast cancers have too much of this gene, too much cell growth, and they're called HER2 positive cancers. Not many of them, only about 15% of breast cancers are what we call HER2 positive. Pardon? No, some stomach cancers are now being tested for HER2, but no. It's only at this moment, no. It's only breast and now some gastric cancers, not all. The important thing is, why do we worry about whether or not the tumour cells have got too much of this protein? Because now we've got some targeted therapies. So we've got some special drugs that we use for HER2 positive tumours. Herceptin, which I think has to be injected. I don't know if anybody's... Yeah. So your tumour would have been HER2 positive. Yeah. And therefore, that means that may be something that the doctors will discuss and think about. If a tumour's HER2 negative, no point giving this targeted therapy because it's not going to work and it's not going to be of any help. So that's why we do all those routine tests and give a positive or a negative result. Now, staging is quite complicated, and it is different for different organ systems. And there's a whole lot of things that go into the staging. It depends on how big the tumour is. It depends on whether there's any lymph nodes involved. Has it spread beyond the breast? Is it DCIS or is it actually invasive cancer? And basically we have stages 1, stage 2, stage 3, stage 4. And if you like, stage 1 is what we call early breast cancer. Stage 4 is advanced breast cancer. So stage 1 means the tumour, as far as can be identified, is present only in the breast. So there's no tumour in the lymph nodes. X-rays show nothing in the lungs. There's no evidence of anything else going anywhere. So it's a stage 1 tumour. Compared with a breast cancer that's spread to the bones, or it's spread to the lungs, or it's spread elsewhere. That's stage 4. And different treatments will be used depending on the stage. So if you like, I just sort of went on that. The staging is, where is the tumour in the body? So now we're not talking about what does it look like down the microscope. We're saying, where is it? If it's just here in the breast, that's stage 1. That's early breast cancer. Here we've got tumour and we've got positive lymph node. That's stage 2. It's already spread to the lymph nodes, so that would be a stage 2 tumour. Now, in this case, we've got tumour in the breast, tumour in the lymph nodes, but we've also got a tumour deposit in one of the lymph nodes in the middle part here, or it's spread to the chest wall. So that's become more locally advanced, and that's a stage 3 tumour. And then if we've got tumour that's spread way beyond the breast, so perhaps to the liver or lung or lymph nodes up in the neck or the brain, that's advanced, and that's, or metastatic breast cancer, that's stage 4. So they're the sort of stages that we talk about. So when we get this specimen, sometimes we're not told all the information, and we can only presume. We presume there's no metastatic disease, so we presume, therefore, if it's only a 5 millimetre cancer and there's no nodes, we presume it's stage 1 because there's no metastasis that we know of or we've been told about.
But do you also put you through the whole body scan
That's a staging procedure. So they're checking to see, is there anything or not, making sure there's nothing anywhere else.
So it is possible also, even though
well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, we're only, you know, the surgeon hasn't written on the slip mets in liver. We're presuming there isn't any mets, otherwise he probably wouldn't have gone ahead and done the operation, he or she. But you're right, the whole staging, they get the information back from us and they say, I know that preoperative scan was clear, therefore I'm happy it's stage 1.
Yes,
yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Or
except the heat, though.
Right. Okay. So, and And things may actually change. I mean, initially there may be a stage one, but perhaps 10 years later you do get a lump in the axilla, and in fact now it's a stage two. So it can go from one stage to the next, but essentially at diagnosis they'll have a stage. So this might be the sort of bottom line. The patient has an invasive ductal cancer. It's grade 2, 18 millimetres. Margins are clear. Axillary nodes negative. ERPR positive. HER2 negative. Stage 1. So that's the sort of summary that is a synthesis of all the preceding information. Now, just as we were mentioning earlier, those little blocks of tissue, we can store those for many, many years, and in fact by law we have to store those for at least 10 years. And interestingly now, with the identification of sort of genetic syndromes and cancer that occurs in families, we get a lot of requests for blocks from 10 years ago on a cancer, and can we please do this new test because it may have implications for family members. So Dad died at 75 of a bowel cancer. Now we see, maybe there's actually a syndrome within that family. Can we test that bowel cancer from 10 years ago? Because son and daughter are worried and concerned. So we can go back and test, use new tests on old tissue, which I think is a really, fantastic thing that we're able to do that. So the tissue sitting in the paraffin can just sit there forever and it's preserved. No. I mean, in fact, the problem for us is where do we store all of these blocks? So after 10 years, we are by law able to start again, but it becomes a real storage issue, and that's the same for every laboratory around. Definitely, yeah. Yep, that's a really good question, because what we can do is now there's a lymph node here, is it metastatic breast cancer? So what we can do is get the breast cancer slides out from 5 years ago and compare the two tumours. Yes, they look the same. Yes, I think the tumour here has spread from the breast. Or no, it looks completely different. You need to look elsewhere. Maybe there's a second new cancer. So that's right. So as well as the blocks, we also keep the glass slides. So the glass slides we keep, and we can just request the slides out from the archive and look at those and review them. So we're constantly doing that as well. So is this tumour that's in the bone, does it look like the breast cancer from 10 years ago? So we can compare them. And sometimes they say, and can you retest for the ERPR HER2? Because that can change over time as well. So a tumour that initially was ER positive, in fact 5 years later it's come back, and in fact now it's ER negative. So that's important, because giving the anti-estrogen tamoxifen won't help in this case, because the tumour sort of changed its spots, if you like.
Talk about the ERPR. Does menopause have anything to do with it?
After menopause, the ERPR status. You can be postmenopausal and have an ER-positive tumour, I think is what you're saying. Is that possible? Yes, it is. So anyone at any age can have an ER-positive tumour. It doesn't matter if you're 90 or 29. Just because you're not producing oestrogen doesn't mean that individual cell can't, I guess, or have the receptor for it. No, they kind of go together, the ER and PR, and really it's not really possible to have a tumour that's ER negative and PR positive. It doesn't really occur in life. The PRs, it's funny, sometimes I wonder why do we do PR, because it's really the ER we're worried about. And I suppose now we're understanding more of the genetics and where the gene for ER is and the gene for PR is, and it's much more complicated than we thought. There are some studies that say that an ER, if both are positive, they'll respond really well to the treatment. Perhaps if the PR was negative, the response maybe, or the overall survival might be slightly different. But the PR is a bit of an add-on, if you like. No, we do. We always report the PR as well. Mm. Yeah.
My mother died of a very, very rare cancer. There was a time when I was dealing with my own cancer. She's been there, but is there a way I can get access to her pathology reports?
Yes, you could probably just write to, did you know, you don't know who the surgeon was or the where it was performed? You could certainly ask one of the, either the pathology directly, or there must be some sort of liaison person to say, I know my mother had surgery here and I'm really interested to get a copy of the pathology report, and they should be able to help you. Mm, I would imagine. You may have to sign something that say that you are her daughter, etc.
I feel very lost.
Not knowing. No, that would be appropriate. And I, you know, it certainly sounds, there should be somebody there that would be able to point you in the right direction.
Yeah.
Mm. I guess it's a little bit different if the person is still alive, because they're the owner of that information and it's confidential. So in that case, they would have to sign something that says, I'm happy for my daughter or son to access my medical information. It does become sensitive in that sense, because there is confidentiality about pathology reports. Mm. And we need to make sure it's going somewhere that the patient is actually consented for that person to get the information. Yeah. Well, we have no way of knowing, from us, we have no way of knowing. That's why we just have the blanket 10-year rule for keeping specimens, but we don't know. I mean, it's the GP that knows whether patients, that their clinical information is sort of a little bit different to tissue custody, if you like. So we don't know whether patients are passed on or not. We don't have that information. Oh, there'd be a report. Absolutely, there'd be a report. Oh, a report would be retained forever. Yes, yes. Reports, we have reports going back many years. Yeah, reports aren't destroyed. The actual tissue, it's a 10-year rule, and then it can be, you know, discarded. But reports should be kept on file. It shouldn't, you know, they should be accessible, unless there's a, you know, computer problem. That, but you know, there would be no reason why they would be discarded after a certain period of time. I don't. That's my off-the-cuff answer. Mm. Well, that might happen if there's a new tumour mass that's occurred and they biopsy it again, but you have to sort of retest it on a new tumour. Yes, yeah. And that certainly does happen, and it can change again. It was negative and now it's positive, or it was positive and now it's negative. Yeah, so it can change with chemotherapy and radiotherapy and time, and the cells continue to sort of mutate and lose and gain proteins, etc. Yeah. Now, HER2 is a normal gene, but it becomes very much amplified, or there are just way too many copies in the breast cancer cells that are HER2 positive. So it is a normal gene, but it becomes abnormal. Yeah. Now, how do we work with surgeons? We do things called frozen sections. So sometimes the patient may be under the anaesthetic and the surgeon calls the pathologist in to say, I'm a little worried about this lump. I wasn't expecting this. Can you please do a frozen section? So we do a quick frozen section. We quickly freeze the tissue, cut the tissue, stain it, you know, in 5-10 minutes, look at it, and go back in and say, it's fine, it's benign, or no, I'm sorry, it is cancer. That's one scenario. Or they may say, look, I've taken this lumpectomy out, I think I'm okay, can you slice it open? Patient's still asleep under the anaesthetic, make sure my margins are all right. That might be one scenario. Or sometimes they've asked us to do a frozen section on a lymph node, a sentinel lymph node. Because if we get that lymph node, we quickly freeze it, stain it, and say, yes, there's actually tumour in the node, the surgeon may go back and take out the whole axilla, take out all the rest of the nodes. And that means the patient's only had one operation, not two. We're tending to do less of these now, but that's one situation where we actually go into the theatre while the operation's still happening. And depending on what we say, will depend on whether or not further surgery is done or further lymph nodes are taken out.
So there's always a pathology?
Not always. No, it's usually pre-arranged. It's booked. They say, I'd like you to come at 2 o'clock. I'm doing this case. I'm taking out some nodes. Can you please do frozen section? So it's only a very small percentage of surgeries, maybe 5. Yeah, or if they're worried or concerned. It happens. It used to be quite common 5-10 years ago. It's becoming less. We're asked less and less perhaps to come in for the breast cancer situation. Sometimes we're asked to come in if there's a cancer of the uterus and the surgeon's worried if it's gone through the wall. And if it looks like it's going into the wall of the uterus, then he or she will probably take some pelvic lymph nodes. So that is a guide for taking extra tissue, doing a sort of wider procedure to check for more tissue to see where we're at. Mm. So they might have called somebody in to say, you know, how invasive is this uterine cancer, and do I need to take the pelvic nodes out? They're the sort of situations. And the other one situation we get involved with talking with all the other colleagues is what's called the multidisciplinary meeting. So in most cases, breast cancers will be discussed at a meeting where there's all these different doctors, and there's people like physios, there's psychologists, often there's a breast care nurse if it's a breast cancer meeting. And essentially what happens is that the case is presented, the pathology is presented, and then there's a discussion about therapeutic options. So, yes, yeah, absolutely, yes. Pathologist, yeah. So we actually take pictures and we go along and we show them. We say this was a grade 2 invasive ductal cancer. As you can see, there's a lot of vascular invasion. The ER was positive and the HER2 was negative. And someone may say, oh, can you just tell me again about the superior margin? And I say, it's 10 millimetres, it's clear, it's fine. So it's an opportunity to, if someone wants to clarify something or, you know, discuss the pathology, if there may be something they weren't sure of, and if the pathologist is there, they can give all the answers. So really, that pathological staging is the basis of which cancer treatment is based. So it's sort of document, the pathology report's sort of quite an important one. Just a little bit about how do we know we're doing the right thing. The good thing is that with these meetings we review all the slides, so we get them out, we may find something different, or was that diagnosis, is it all fitting together? We have to do continuing programs, and laboratories are assessed by NATA. So all of these things are in place to make sure that the results we're putting out are accurate. And I think that was probably all I had to say. So thank you for that, and for your attention. And I'd be happy to answer any other questions that you may have.
I just wanted to very briefly say that I asked for my pathologies and results because no one can give them to me. And I did receive them, but it took me 6 months before I decided maybe I'm going to read them.
Mm.
All that.
I think there's a lot of information there, and I would recommend if anybody, you know, you may have your own pathology reports, look through them, but then I'd actually go to your GP and say, look, can you just work through this with me, because I'm finding it a bit overwhelming, because I would find it overwhelming. I can't read a car manual because I find that very foreign. So it's a foreign language to a lot of people, and I think having someone there who can understand and explain is really helpful. And you may get concerned or worried about a particular item in the report, and if it's explained, I think it makes it better. And you can put it into context, because I think you need the background of the person and someone who knows the person to help explain and work your way through it, because it's a complicated piece of medical terminology, really. Well, that's the other problem. Then you can start looking into the internet, and you know, that can be confronting sometimes. So, yeah. So I think always, you know, nice friendly GP or your surgeon who's got a little bit, you know, 5 minutes just to work through it with you is probably a good idea. Invasion? Yes. Yes. No. Well, the short answer is no. It depends if you wanted to spend, you know, $50,000 and do super, super sensitive tests, the so-called molecular tests, then you might pick up some circulating cells, but they're not thought to be significant and it's not a routine at all. So basically in practice...
Well, it's not significant, it's,
Yeah, well, I suppose the answer is there's some tumour markers that certainly you can look. Yeah. Well, there's been studies where they do very specific genetic techniques and they can pick up tiny amounts of cells, but it's not been proven to show anything in the sense of how does it affect the long-term outlook. We know that it's in the bloodstream. It doesn't really matter whether you see them in these tiny amounts or not. You probably get the appropriate therapy because they've seen it in the breast, so it's not going to really add anything in the blood. It's not a routine test and it's not recommended and it's not done is what I'm really saying. Yeah. There's tumour markers which you can use to follow, and if there's a rise in that, then that's a concern and they'll go looking, has the tumour recurred? But no, there's not sort of something that you... There may be in the future, definitely. And I mean, that may be the way if things go and where... I don't know what happens to us, but I think we'll be around for a little bit longer. But in the future, that may be something that happens. Oh, there's various tumour markers that are the cancers. There's CA125, which is sort of more for ovary, and there's CA153, which is more for breast, and there's others that are more for liver. The thing is, they're not entirely 100% specific. So, in fact, you may have a benign condition in the ovary and a high CA125. It doesn't necessarily mean it's cancer. But in a patient who has known ovarian cancer and they've had surgery and it's been clear, the surgeon will usually do a 6-monthly, 12-monthly blood test, and if there's actually starting to be a rise in that, that is a concern. It depends. It's all written on. It's like, you know, it depends which one you're talking about. They're usually like less than 5 or less than 20. Someone with ovarian cancer, I've seen levels as high as 13,000 when they should be less than 20. So there's obvious, yes, this is ovarian cancer versus... this is not. But that's more of a clinical thing. That's not sort of something we do. It's a blood test, so, yeah. But the good thing is we can actually look at that result, and that just adds to the whole picture of where that patient is at. Yes, that's right, biochemistry, yeah. Oh, that was in the grading. It's in the grade 1, grade 2, grade 3. Well, there are three things we look at to give the grade. It's the nucleus. What does it look like? How bad is it? Are they forming tubules, and how mitotically active is it? So how can we see mitoses? That is, yeah. So it's in the grading, the nuclear grades in the grading. Yeah. Sounds like you've read the report very carefully. And look, it's very, the genetics of cancer is very complicated, and there are very specific, you know, family genetic cancer clinics, and they're sort of specialised doctors that deal in that area. So they take a very detailed family history and work out somebody's likely risk and whether or not you need to be further investigated. It's not just the case that, oh, my dad had cancer, therefore I'm at increased risk. It may or may not be. It's a very complicated, it depends on what type of cancer it was, how old he was when he got it, all those sorts of things. So with a lot of the hereditary breast cancers, it's the important thing in taking the history is, well, in fact, three of my sisters and my aunt, and they all had it before they were 30. That's a big red flag for, it could be one of these hereditary cancer ones if they're very young when they get the cancer. If it's thought that it's warranted to do testing, you can. Certainly it would... and the thing is, anyone can pay for anything, but is it actually appropriate? So that's why if you go to a genetic... the surgeon will obviously look, and sometimes they say, I think we should refer to the genetic clinic, and they will then decide whether or not further investigation is warranted, depending on the family history. And some people may not want to know and may not want to be tested and may not want to know the results of the sister's test. So it can become very difficult, I think, complicated. Mm. We all have a general risk, and then there are others that have an increased risk because of these genetic familial Just last one? Yeah.
Just a very last question. I always hear people always say that every single one of us is born with cancer already in us. Is that true?
No.
Thank you.
I don't believe so. No. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. You can subscribe to Brecan's podcasts or browse existing ones at our website, www.brecan.org.au.